This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. 7 guests, 7 corners.
On this week's show.
Well, yeah, it's good enough for me, but not for you.
He went on stage in a dressing gown.
The Muggle hordes. Have you ever ran with a horde?
I have. That's a bad bunch.
Follow me. Come on, there we go.
And your host,
Mr. Paul
Carenza. Hello there. Thank you. Welcome. Podcast 14. Here we go. We have had a summer break. Hope that yours was existent, I suppose. Ours wasn't really existent as a summer break. We went to Cornwall for 2.5 weeks, which was nice. I thought I would work remotely, and I didn't remotely work, I think it's probably fair to say. Well, I did a bit. Some not going out. Next series is underway. That's all good fun. And also some currently top secret writing for a show which will be on just before Christmas. But yes, our Cornish summer was mostly rainy, which is hardly fair. And then, of course, late August came and September and all that sort of stuff. And then I went into hospital for a few days. I won't go into vast details here, but if you are interested, I've done a Pause for Thought on Radio 2 about this very thing just last week. So you can find that on my Facebook page if you fancy, but details there, not here. Let's just leave it at that. But we do get a bit medical on this episode of the podcast. We've got storyteller Becca Barron with a story about some surprise surgery in Bangkok, which is... And it's not a risk if you travel there, I promise you that. We've got comedian Carl Donnelly, not just any comedian, but Chortle Comedian of the Year, Carl Donnelly, that is. He's talking medical stage attire. Oh, and what a perfect time to mention my slightly medical one-man show, Navelless Gazing, which is in London this very weekend. So if you are quick and listening to this early, and also if you are in shouting distance of the capital, this Saturday, 23rd of September, at the fabulous Museum of Comedy. I realise that most of you won't be listening to this on the week of release. So let me also say that I'm at Liverpool Comedy Festival next week, Tuesday 26th, although I realise also you're unlikely to listen to this by then either. I've got Nottingham Comedy Festival in November as well. That's currently the last date for Navelless Gazing, which is in November the something. But the show will certainly be in the back pocket for future use if demand is there. So the show got 5 stars at Camden Fringe, which is very nice, in the Open Door Fringe Review, which I'd never heard of. But now it's given me 5 stars. It's my favourite publication. And they don't give everyone 5 stars. I did do the research on that just to make sure. It's not one of those eBay delivery ratings where everyone gets 5. But yeah, Museum of Comedy this weekend with funny man Rob Thomas. Book online, museumofcomedy.com. And it's a beautiful place, regardless of my show. If you ever listen in the future, get to the Museum of Comedy. You can actually see they've got Del Boy's cap, Steptoe's toe or whatever, I don't know, but they've got comedy artifacts through the years, so I would thoroughly recommend coming early and looking at those. Back to the podcast. Speaking of museums, and indeed of comedy, we have a wealth of museum-like knowledge this episode for you, largely from comedians as well, but we've also got a few muggles thrown in as well. We've got Dominic Frisby bringing his financial know-how. We've got Eric McElroy on how to be a TV pundit, radio producer Chris Byland on what, radio production. If you don't know the podcast, we have 7 guests a week in 7 corners of this pseudo-club that we find ourselves in. And we have a star guest as well each time, and this time from our live show, the fantastic Tony Law. Now, he's up right now. There is a brief early swear, which I've covered with a strange noise. So if you hear that, just get past the siren, and we'll move on from there, shall we? So we trailed Tony last week. If you don't know him, he's a fantastic freewheeling Canadian comedian, so expect anything. And last time he was just telling us that he'd been reading a fine history book. Oh, did I mention, by the way, that I had a new book out last week? Hark, The Biography of Christmas. Well, more on that coming up. I can't do all the plugs straight away. It's rather rude, I know. But yes, right now, Tony Law, he's been reading about the history of the Silk Road.
Yeah, I just want to say Silk Road, I like it. Well, like me, Genghis Khan is responsible for the modern world. Him more. Me a little bit less, but...
I know little about the Silk Road, but I presume it's something to do with conquest and commerce. Is that about right? It's all in there somewhere? Is it sort of
mostly just commerce. Okay. Mostly people wanting good stuff.
And then taking it maybe...
Yeah, and finding a way to get it across. And everything was closed up till Genghis kicked the doors open. I think we'll all agree with that.
Yeah.
The Mongols.
Yeah, good.
The Mongol hordes. Have you ever ran with a horde?
I
have. That's a bad bunch. People are worried about the gangs around, you know? That was the gang. Yes. The gang. Tough. Small, but tough, yeah, and mobile.
That's true.
When you're from the future, though, and you travel back to ride with them, you look like a on horseback. Because we're much bigger now. I'm here to tell you, we're a lot bigger than
we were.
Yeah, we're much bigger. Yeah, it's the diet. You know, if I played middle linebacker in the NFL right now, I'd be small. In the 80s, I was the ideal size. I'm actually the same weight now as I was when I was 17, but it's all fat now.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know why I just jumped in there, NFL.
Okay. Yeah.
I like everything I liked when I was 17 now.
So did you like the Silk Road back then?
Is this really liked the Silk Road. I was a Sogdian trainer. Trainer? Yeah, I trained Sogdian traders.
Okay. What does that mean?
You know, facial expressions don't scan on the old podcast, do they? Just working out. I just came out to work on some new face moves.
That's fun.
That's my favorite one. I can't stop doing this one, lady. As soon as I buy mirrors. So, Silk Road. Yeah, that's what we were talking about.
Yeah,
it's important.
I mean, you
all about silk, not just silk.
Yeah.
Ideas.
Christ.
Think of everybody. You know what? I think if everyone was forced to learn about the Silk Road, a lot better world.
There's been a documentary on the BBC 4.
There's been a fair few, and I've seen them. And there's some crazy old ones on YouTube. That's the best way to watch documentaries. But you have to be careful, because 10 minutes in, you're like, no, I'm pretty sure that's not true.
So more Tony Law in a bit, but plenty more guests to get through. 7 a week, that's our goal. So Tony's been here before. Let's also welcome back another comedian who's been here before, a man who knows all about money. This is Dominic Frisby.
Society's always going to be unequal, because no two people are the same. And, you know, even within a family, there's inequality. Inequality is inevitable. If you want diversity and variety and everything else, inequality is inevitable. But the financial inequality that we are going through at the moment, the wealth inequality, is unprecedented in the history of the free world. Obviously, if you include slaves and so on, it's not. But in the history of the free world, it's almost unprecedented. And so much of it is a consequence, and the biggest one, of course, we have in the UK at the moment is the wealth inequality. Who owns a house and who doesn't is the single biggest divide, and that is purely on the basis of when you were born. Mm-hmm. In other words, when normal people could afford a house and when they no longer can. And house prices, people think house prices are caused by lack of land. Actually, house prices are caused by a failing system of credit. It's the amount of credit in house prices that have pushed them up to these ridiculous levels. If there was no credit in the housing market, house prices would be directly relative to earnings, to what people earned. But because you mentioned the mortgage and then all these ways they found of putting credit into the housing market, that's created this thing where anyone under the age of 30 can't afford a house, and anyone over the age of 40 is, you know, has probably got a nice one within things. So yes, so it monetary policy is the failings of monetary policy, the injustices and the incompetence of monetary policy have led to the rise of extremist politics.
I see. Wow. Well, I didn't expect to get that from but to be honest, I'm financially all over the place.
You shouldn't be, though, because you're a bright young man.
Well, in theory, I should be. I should be more interested in it than I am. I should be looking at the stocks and shares. I look at the week and go, oh, that's going up and that's going down. I should buy some of those or sell some of those, whatever. And, of course, you never do.
Speaking of money, we've had actual donations. Thank you so much for those. A big thank you to Anna and Chris Gramstad. That's fantastic. You are gold star superstars and super supporters of the Heptagon Club. Guests of honour, indeed. You have no idea the warmth and joy it is to see a donation ping into my email inbox from strangers as well. And that's always encouraging and lovely and brilliant. So we thank you for that. That just means that people enjoy the podcast enough to dip into their pockets. And that means that we'll keep making more. We have to. You've invested now. So if you would also like to donate, heptagonclub.co.uk, click donate, and you have no idea the smile it will bring to my face when I get a little notification that someone has done that. You can also click the Patreon button, which is the top right of heptagonclub.co.uk, if you would like to give something regular, and for that you gain bonus treats and things and rewards and all that sort of stuff. But any donation, 5, 10, 20, 2, 200, 2,000, 4, whatever, all welcome. and also heart-meltingly appreciated. I cannot put it into words. So this podcast does cost in terms of kit and travel, so we thank you for that. A thank you to what I will call a mystery donor for now, for a very generous sum, and we will probably say no more than that. Between me and him, we sort of know that we kind of came to some arrangement where I did not take that entire generous sum because of other reasons, but it was very delightful and generous and kind and benevolent and beneficent. Is that a word? It's a word. I don't quite know if it's right for this particular context. But anyway, if you are listening, mystery donor, and you want to be demystified and unanonymized, is that I'm making up words left, right, and centrified here. Anyway, I will gladly reveal your name on a future week. But for now, I will play it safe and just say thank you, mystery person. You are very kind. You know who you are. You have paid a price of which I am blushing just talking about. But anyway, so money is very embarrassing subject matter. Thank you for demystifying that. Dominic Frisbee, our previous money guru guest there. He'll be returning with more talk on a future episode as well. Always a delight to welcome return guests. We've got a few this week. We've got Tony Law again back in a sec. But speaking, as Dominic was there, of divided unequal wealth, here are some tales of a far-off tax haven from comedian David Whitney.
I was very lucky last year. I did some gigs out of Panama, and it was the most amazing experience to go to Panama.
Is there a Panamanian circuit?
Well, there isn't, but there was, because they've got so many expats from Britain and America, because it's essentially the Canary Wharf dropped in the middle of a rainforest.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Because it's where it's the America's Switzerland. Where they clean or hide their money. But every gig, there were the same problems, like a sort of like 20-foot gap between the stage and the audience, which we all know is a killer for comedy.
Yeah.
And I was the headliner, and at each one I was moving furniture before going on, and moving lights and stuff. And as we went to each gig, and it was still, it's like, I felt like, do these guys think I'm some sort of prima donna or something? Yeah. Do they think that I'm like,
it looks bad, doesn't it? It does.
We've got Whitney moving the furniture. We've flown him out here, put him up in a good hotel, and he's just like moaning about where the light. This isn't me demanding blue M&Ms.
No, it's not. You're a feng shui obsessive. It'll make the gig work.
I just want the gig to be better for everybody. Yeah. You know, I'm not, you know.
Yeah,
I've said that for everybody. Like, I like the idea. I like the idea that a comedian would change the furniture so the gig was set up properly, but only for when he was on stage.
Oh yeah, that'd be nice. And then move it back again during someone else's act. That's always nice, isn't it? It can look a little like we're not in this together, can't it? You know, my wife actually used to suggest, when I used to keep coming back with colds and stuff and gigs that I just pick up at Edinburgh and stuff, and she used to say, well, you've got your own microphone, why don't you just, as the comp introduces you, and then you walk on, and then you unplug the microphone, and then plug in your own one.
That would be the most 20 minutes, hilarious thing. And then take it back.
Then take it back again, you know. You can have your germ-ridden microphone. Which she genuinely meant it, you know.
And she's... Or you could get some disinfectant wet wipes.
Yes, yes.
And as you take the stage, take out these.
Yeah. You can see the temptation, can't you? Really, you know, it's like when you go to Tokyo and they've all got those masks on.
It's like, what? The air's good enough for me, but not for you.
Exactly.
And then you sort of like see them taking them off to get Pepsi, please.
We're going to put the tube down here, and you can have the Pepsi that way. It's not quite going to work, is it? Mate? Yeah, not going to work.
The Heptagon Club.
Seven guests, seven corners. The Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza.
But I get terrified if the audience is a little bit like right wingy.
Yeah.
Even though, like, that's kind of what I was when I set out.
It's a tricky thing, isn't it? You can't tell, can you, when you come in and you start a joke and you go, oh, you're that way. Oh, you're this way. And it's tricky, isn't it? Well, how do you deal with that?
How do I tell?
Yeah, or do you ask?
There's a certain face that says, you don't know how to do what you're doing, which I get quite a bit. And it's usually kind of.
I have to describe another facial.
I get that. As soon as I see too many of them, I just look down to the left. And you can just say, and I want to shout to them and go, just open your mind for a minute. It'll get good. And then I go.
I wish you were a video podcast.
Podcast.
That would be nice.
Am I right?
So Tony Law is a man who changes fashions every year or two on stage. I don't mean he changes on stage. That would be rather revealing. But he does ring in some on-stage haute couture changes, shall we say that much. So here is another comedian who does just the same, in fact. He brings in new styles to stand out as a stand-up. He's a top comic. We are lucky to have him. It's Carl Donnelly.
I'm sure you won't mind me saying this.
Oh, yeah, go on.
But comedian Joe Bohr.
Oh, yeah.
Went through a phase of wearing a man bag on stage.
Oh, right.
And he did have a joke about a man bag, but the actual wearing of it was unnecessary. I think people would have understood the joke.
Well, I think you expect props as well if you've got a bag.
Yeah, but no, it was just as bad. And I think it was part of him was thinking that would be quite a cool thing to. I think there was a thought process behind it other than just I'm going to wear my bag on stage.
I think colostomy bag on stage would be a nice look.
Have it out.
Display. Yeah,
a display.
And maybe not refer to it.
Right.
Oh, and speaking of colostomy, which is it's actually one of the few medical ailments that I don't have, but in my new show, I am trying to unburden some taboos on, let's say urological climbs. Can I say that much? I just did. So this new show I'm doing, Navelous Gazing, it is a weird show. I don't know how happy I am talking about it, but I'm doing it under medical advice. The doctors want me to break down a few barriers, and I'm delighted to do that. So if that includes doing a weird show about my innards, then so be it. Thankfully, though, the reviews have been very kind. 5 stars, according to the Open Door Fringe Review. You can see for yourself this weekend in London, Saturday, the 23rd of September at the Museum of Comedy. Next week in Liverpool Comedy Festival, Nottingham Comedy Festival in November. Just Google Paul Carenza, Navelous Gazing. It's all on my website, all that sort of stuff. Sorry for the plug. Anyway, we are interrupting here, Carl Donnelly.
Chris Martin, the comedian.
Yes.
Coldplay.
Not the non-comedian.
He's currently living in LA for 5 months.
Oh, is he?
And he did a gig recently, about a week ago, and he messaged me saying he did a gig with a guy who went on stage in a dressing gown.
Right.
Which I like.
That's a look.
That is a bold look.
The last time I saw Chris Martin properly was years ago, and he was running a gig up in the northeast, I believe. Is that right?
Newcastle.
That's right. And he said, oh, it includes accommodation, which was at his place, basically.
Yeah.
And it was really just which two flatmates were out at the time and could have their room. And I remember staying in, and again, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, well, he hasn't got a choice, he's in LA.
Yeah.
But the two rooms I got to choose from, they were both sort of student-y, but one had a leaflet on the side by the bed saying, the student's guide to chlamydia. And the other one had the student's guide to herpes. And I've never had that choice before, going, I'd better Google which
you
is
would have
the...
chlamydia, surely.
I think I went for chlamydia.
Yeah, chlamydia is one that...
You've got to be careful when you're chlamydia.
So, yes, we are medical this week. Now, enough on my medical comedy show. I think we've dwelt on that enough. But I will mention another free thing that I'm doing. This is your Bring a Bottle moment this week. Bring a Bottle is the chance each episode to give something back, your invitation to bring something to the party yourself. Because, we've got these guests for you here. Why not mingle in and join a little bit? So, yes, you could come to my Navelous Gazing shows in London, Liverpool or Nottingham. And or I have a book launch in Guildford on October the 1st or in London, it's not really on. I suppose it's on. You're standing on London ground, put it that way. That's October the 11th. So this new book is Hark, the Biography of Christmas. It's the history of Christmas, really. Every single bit of Christmas culture and custom is explored in its historical roots and what's led up to it. It's sort of fun and trivia-filled and a bit QIE, but also, I don't know, it's more thorough than I'd planned on it being, to be honest. I've been working on it for the last couple of years. I'm fiercely proud of it, and I've got the book. I only got it on Thursday last week, which was quite exciting. I didn't even think it would make it this far, to be honest, because if I'm honest, the company, the publishers, actually went into administration on the very day that I handed the manuscript in. So they've been operating on a skeleton team for the last best part of a year, really. So finally, when one book landed on my doormat on Thursday last week, it was a delight to see, really. It was a couple of days before I got another batch of 100 or so I could take them to gigs and things and sell. But I had one copy on Friday morning that I went up to do Radio 2, Pause for Thought, with my one copy. And I thought, well, Chris Evans, he's very kindly written the foreword. I should give it to him, this one copy. I should just hang on to it. It's good to have, isn't it? And then actually they have the celebrity guests in Radio 2 on a Friday morning at the breakfast show. Gary Barlow was there. I thought, well, I could give my copy to Gary Barlow. He might tweet about it. He's unlikely to, but it's nice to know that he's got the first copy. But what other guests do they have there? Colin Firth. He was there that day. Well, who do you give your one copy to? Gary Barlow or Colin Firth? What a dilemma. So I was flicking through the book and I realised, actually, I'd forgotten completely, Colin Firth is in the book. I have referenced him in the history of Christmas. So I've got to give it to him. So I pick my moment. We finish the breakfast show. It's like 9:35. Ken Bruce is on air. Popmaster's all gearing up. Everyone's mingling around. Lots of managers, agents and things. And Colin Firth's there in the green room. So I sort of went up to him and he gave me a little nod and said, oh, well done on the Pause for Thought. And Thank you very much indeed, Colin. I said, may I, Mr. Firth, may I give you this book? I said, this is literally the only copy in existence. There are no other copies right now that I know of. I mean, they are out there, but this is the only copy I have. May I give you this book? And he looked at it, and very kindly, he said, oh, well, History of Christmas. And I said, yes, well, you're in there. He said, of course I am. He said, of course I'm in the History of Christmas. Christmas Jumpers, Bridget Jones's Diary, of course, all that sort of thing. And I thought, oh, no, I've missed a trick there. I've not got him in for that. I've got him in for the King's Speech. When George VI didn't want to do the King's Speech that Christmas because of the stammer, and then he did, and it made the country like him more. So, Colin's there reminding me that actually, he seems to think that he has this role as the King of Christmas Jumpers. I suppose maybe he did. I've sort of put it down to Val Dunick and Andy Williams and Alan Partridge, but missed a trick, something to revise for the second edition, perhaps. Anyway, more copies have arrived. I will be launching the book on October the 1st in Guildford. Why didn't I get Colin Firth as a guest on this show? That's what I should have said to him. Should have said, forget the book. Colin, speak into this. Be a guest on our podcast. That would have been very nice indeed. Maybe a future time we'll have Colin Firth as the star guest. Maybe I should have asked Gary Barlow. Maybe he would have been on the podcast. Anyway, my point is, getting distracted, Carenza. October 1st in Guildford at the Keep Pub. That is our book launch. Also, October the 11th in London at Blackwell's Bookshop in Holborn. So we've got a pub in Guildford, a bookshop in London. That's how it works. The bookshop as well, the Blackwell's Holborn Bookshop, is the nearest bookshop to Charles Dickens' house. That's the Dickens house, the Dickens Museum. The idea being, you could actually go to Dickens' house and museum before the book launch, up, I think close at 5, have a bit of dinner, come out for 6:30 to Blackwell's, launch the Christmas book. You will never have as Christmassy and festive a day as that. It's only a shame in a way, it's October the 11th and not full on Christmas season. But if you want to get in the spirit early, just for one day, on October 12th, you can go back to hating Christmas again until December. But October 11th, if you fancy coming out, it's a free event, right? So it's open to everybody, open invite, but you need to be on the list because both in the Guildford place and the London place, space is finite. So email hohohumbug@gmail.com. That is hohohumbug@gmail.com. You can be on the free list. You can bring people. You just need to let me know for numbers. There'll be a short talk from me on the history of Christmas, some festive nibbles. It's fun. It's festive. It's early, I know, but just get past that, get the book out and all that sort of stuff and join me there. We'll have a little glass of wine. If you would like to, Guildford or London, you are most welcome. Just email us, hohohumbug@gmail.com. And I'll be telling more about the Christmas book, particularly on our December episode of this podcast. But for now, come to the launch. That's your bring a bottle moment. Rather a long way of saying it this week, but I had to go via when you get a Colin Firth anecdote like that, you need to drop it in somehow. There's no easy way. Anyway, RSVP if you want to come, or indeed, better still, part with cash, Navelous Gazing, Museum of Comedy, September 23rd, Liverpool, 26th, Nottingham, November sometime. You know the rest. Ah! Right, relief. Let's have another guest. Radio producer Chris Byland, who can tell me really where I'm going wrong in waffling away too much, perhaps. You know, how do you best become a radio presenter? Chris Byland.
Obviously, glittering career, which the highlight of which I'm sure would be an afternoon show. So a year or two ago when basically you produced the only time that I've ever presented anything sort of publicly that's not hospital radio. I'm feeling this should really become some sort of appraisal.
Appraisal. You know,
so,
okay.
How do I go from here? How do you make a good radio presenter? Brackets. How do I make a good radio presenter? But you know, more generally, the world. You know, advice for the world at large. But feel free to reference the mistakes I made 18 months ago.
Oh well, I think I came across that the other day.
Actually. Oh really? Oh dear.
And I don't think
I thought they burnt the copies.
No, was it really 18 months? But how do you? I don't know. I mean, to be a radio presenter,
yeah,
you need to be willing to share as much as you physically can,
right,
with those people who might send you letters.
Very true.
That is literally what it is, yes. And being able to share your life in a way that relates to the people that might be listening.
Are there two different types of presenters as well? This is how I see it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who, I don't know, operate the deck, run the thing, know what buttons to push, basically, and the ones who don't, and who just turn up and say things, and other people push the buttons and make it all happen.
It depends on the radio station.
Right.
Firstly, there are some radio stations where the latter would happen.
Indeed.
Mainly the BBC, where someone will press buttons for you.
Yeah.
And then a lot of radio stations now, presenters also have to be producers.
Right.
And they really need the nous to be able to open a microphone and talk at the same time.
Mm.
it's a difficult job, but someone's got to do it.
Very true, very true. I'm always amazed and impressed when I've worked with Chris Evans and his the buttons and
oh,
speed
loads.
and thinking ahead all the time while speaking at the same time.
Have you ever watched some of those videos from the 90s of especially American videos of some of those stations in America where they've got cartwheels? So it's not obvious. Everything now is digital, so it's coming off a computer.
Yes.
Some of those stations in America were playing things off of cassettes. Mm. They were playing them off of, carts.
Yes, I remember the carts.
And to some point, vinyl. Mm. And amongst all that, you know, adverts were coming off like little cart machines as well. So while presenting and doing this really high energy show, they were having to push about a million buttons all at the same time, change records, flip records over, get the right cart machine, and then just do it. It was, if you ever get the chance to watch some of those videos back in the 90s.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a great one of, I think it's Neil Fox.
Okay.
He might have been at Capitol. I saw it on YouTube the other day, and literally he is left, right and centre with his hands trying to make things come together. It sounds amazing, but obviously you never get to see it as driving along in your car.
I could imagine this is a new form of visual entertainment, watching 90s DJs.
Well, Chris did that. Chris Evans did that.
Right.
He was one of the very first. When he owned Virgin, he had a Sky TV channel. It might have even been on Sky One for a couple of hours every single day. And you'd watch Chris in the studio on Sky doing his breakfast show. And he was sort of one of the first people to do that.
Right.
And obviously it then all changed and Chris wasn't a Virgin anymore.
Yes.
But Chris was doing that long before anyone else.
Sort of pre-webcam kind of
thing. Yeah, it was almost because we had webcams and and you would watch sort of people updated every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, look, he's moved a coffee mug. Oh, look, he's moved a microphone. Oh, who's that in the corner? Oh, it's gone again.
I forgot that. They was like still webcams, weren't they?
Yeah, they were still.
I'd forgotten that.
So Chris was sort of a pioneer for that. But they weren't playing music videos, so when the music was on you would hear the music, but obviously all you would see was an image of the studio of people just moving around. It didn't really make any sense.
Yes.
But he was the leader of that.
Okay.
Sort of thing.
Fair
people
play.
Forget that.
So lots of repeat guests this week. We have had Chris there telling us how to make great radio. More from him after another welcome return to our seven-sided club. Also here in the how-to corner, we've had how to present radio. Let's now have how to be a TV pundit from Eric McElroy.
The punditry stuff has been interesting. You get listed as a comic doing it or a satirist or something. So you're on the sofa at breakfast where if you try and say a gag, they sort of, like the very first time I ever did it, I was talking about the fact I have a British passport now, and the woman said to me, I can't remember which presenter it was, why did you move to UK? And I said, well, it's to steal a British person's job. And she just looked at me and went,
oh no,
you're joking. And I was like, look at the little thing under my name. Look at,
exactly.
So because it's not Mock the Week, they book you in to be funny, but then when you are funny, they either cut you off before you've delivered the punchline, or sometimes it's serious enough that you need to be, hopefully thoughtful.
Yep.
But then people are, oh, you're supposed to be the comedian, that kind of tone. So it's there's moments where I felt like I've really nailed it, and you kind of lean into it in the right way, and I've learned how to do it better. But there's moments where I feel like that was weird.
You have to.
I think I sounded like an dork.
You've got to not wait for the laugh, I suppose, haven't you? There ain't going to be one.
I mean, it was nice if you can make people laugh. But, I think I've gotten better at it, but it's weird to practice something, like an open spot, but in front of a few million people.
Exactly.
They're low impact. I mean, I've done a few where someone's texted me from Sky News or something, and they're in Malaysia, and they're like, TV in Malaysia.
There you go. That gets you more, more profile and audience than 2 a.m. at the Invisible Dot.
There is a punditry circuit of people that's what they do, because these things do pay a tiny bit of money.
Yeah,
and it's not as much as one would think, but you get a bit of, but there's people that are like, that's their like, I bet one person, and this kind of makes a living off of doing pop-ups on Sky and BBC radio and that kind of thing.
There's like yourself, Kate Smurthwaite obviously does some, and I did hear that Katie Hopkins was doing all right from just doing those, doing like 5-6 a day. That can be your job.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And if you can bear being Katie Hopkins.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
she's.
But then, of course, that will generate her own, opinions, which yeah. kind of, so we can blame the punditry circuit yeah. for creating Katie Hopkins in many ways.
Yeah, I think, so it's I don't want to get pigeonholed in that because I'm yeah. not an, I think some people have gotten into it and become more of an activist than comedian, and I want to still be much on the comedy side. So if I don't want to get stuck in that, but at the same time, it's interesting talking about what I care about, and if when there's money in there, that's obviously nice. Right, that makes my wife not look at me with that.
Yeah, it's when they call up and say, you know, it'll be 6 a.m. or 7 a.m., can we speak to you at this thing, and
yeah.
can we come and do this? And then you think, it's a bit of an early start for zero pay, but if they pay, suddenly, okay, yeah. we can make this work.
I
mean, you know,
can justify fine. Everything yeah. else. So, because I would imagine you've gotten some of those calls for being kind of a comedian yeah, that's done... I would imagine is that the
particularly
they look for a very specific
yeah,
angle,
and
think.
Particularly Sunday mornings, either Sunday morning radio shows okay. or the occasional Sunday morning BBC One, whatever they have,
yep.
you know, they have an Earth show or Big Questions and stuff like that. And so I've done the Big Questions once or twice, which is, you know, going into this, but it's one of those bit like Question Time. They go, "We are live from Glasgow,"
yeah.
so it's that crucial question. Whenever they say, "Can you be on the Big Questions yeah. this Sunday?" Where are you?
Yeah.
Orkney? No, I'm sorry, I cannot do the double up.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they never realise that I'm gigging the night before somewhere.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get back at 2 o'clock in the morning from Barnstable.
Yep.
And then I've got to try and get to work. So,
yeah.
Tricky.
Doing BBC Breakfast sounds fun, but it's in Salford now.
Of course
and
it is.
There's nothing wrong with Salford or the yeah. north of England in general.
Yeah.
But I live in London, and
yeah,
so that means you've got to go up the night before
yep.
and, you know, get up early and everything else. But to be on the sofa for 2 minutes.
Yes.
I mean,
that's it. Bye again.
Well, like, bye. Yeah, 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah,
and then you're done. Back on the train. So, you know, but that's most of our life as comedians.
That's punditry.
Traveling.
That's what they say. That old catchphrase, that's punditry.
Exactly.
Chris Byland.
I used to be a football coach.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What did you coach?
So I coached youth football for 12 years.
Right, okay.
I didn't have a child.
Right.
But...
Well, that's not a prerequisite for coaching the children, is it? No.
No, but I was quite young, and I was one of the few people... Because most dads get into it, because they are...
Oh, that's true, yes.
You know, you get your son for free, or daughter in this case,
or
whatever. But the sheer comedy, because you are a innocent bystander,
yes,
effectively, you have no bias towards anyone.
Right.
And the sheer politics of football on a Sunday morning... Mm. Between a group of 11-year-old kids. The 11-year-old kids are fine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
parents?
The parents.
It's the parents, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I imagine.
Parents are nasty.
Presumably getting into it a little bit too much, not realising it's just a game.
Yes.
All that sort of stuff.
All of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And they will literally hammer you for anything, like not enough oranges...
Yeah.
Why is my son not playing? And generally shout abuse
yes.
at you.
Yes. Did you coach any David Beckhams or anything? Or you
I
don't
did.
Know, of course.
I do.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Oh,
so
you?
Two of my players went on
really?
To be professional.
Okay.
Which is quite nice.
Very good.
One of them went on to West Ham.
Okay, I've heard of them.
They're kind of cool.
They're good.
But I saw the Beckham.
Right, okay.
Giggs, Scholes, Era.
Yeah.
I saw the
Era. Era is a great one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Brilliant play.
I saw the 99 season.
Right.
But the problem I had was I saw them win everything. And I was only... I must have been like 10 or 11.
Right.
No, I must have been older than that.
Okay,
I was doing my GCSEs.
Yes.
How would you do...
Well, you would have been advanced if you were doing them at 10 or 11.
Yeah.
So
well, I'm not that clever.
15, 16,
I
yeah,
15,
imagine.
16.
Yeah.
So... I had the opportunity to go to the Nou Camp, then watch the final.
Right.
Barcelona.
Yeah.
Bayern Munich, Manchester United. And my mum wouldn't let me go.
Well, you got your GCSEs to do it.
Well, this is it. And we watched it on TV at home. Mm. And she said to me, about 88 minutes, bearing in mind Manchester United losing 1-0. Mm. She said, "Oh, I bet you're glad you didn't go all the way to Barcelona now."
Yeah.
As to which point,
of course.
2 minutes later,
yeah.
a goal.
Yeah, well,
and then another goal.
You never know. You never know which will be the next 1966 World Cup final that you know
exactly.
you have to be there. Yeah.
The most annoying thing is I failed my geography exam the following day. So even if I had gone, it wouldn't have made any difference.
Well, I was going to say, if the subject you're meant to be studying is geography, then surely going to Barcelona might help. That's a place.
It would have helped.
Isn't
I would have learned no Spanish.
Yeah.
I would have learned nothing about tapas.
But something, as long as you know, if there's a question in the thing, you know, what is the capital of the Barcelona region of Spain? Barcelona, obviously.
Obviously
then you would have been there for that.
All right, there was Chris Byland. And our last guest this week is a newcomer. We've had lots of repeat guests. We love a newbie, though. So from our live show earlier this year, we are delighted to welcome a bona fide storyteller. She co-runs the 10x9 Story Night in Balham. I've done it. It's a fantastic night. If you're interested in storytelling and you're in South London, get to Balham for the 10x9 Story Night. So Becca Barron, this is. She brought us this true and quite medical tale. So be warned. Here's Becca Barron.
I know far more about my insides than I ever thought I would. It's 2009, I'm 22 years old, and I'm travelling through Southeast Asia. Done Cambodia, done Vietnam, I'm about to take on Laos. My travelling companion is my good friend Dan. Key thing to know about Dan is that he looks a lot like Harry Potter, and so we got hounded pretty much everywhere we went. And this kind of drove him crazy. And what I would do to help the situation is tell the people around us that he had, in fact, been Daniel Radcliffe's stunt double in the first three films. So was, to all intents and purposes, Harry Potter. We get to Laos and the town of Vang Vieng. Vang Vieng is a strange place. It is overrun with Western tourists. And this phenomenon of friends bars has popped up. To cater for all these tourists. So there are these bars that just show Friends 24/7. There are a couple that show The Simpsons. There's one that specialises in, I believe, John Travolta films. But mainly the town is people lying about watching Friends reruns. The first night that we're in Vang Vieng, I start to feel a little bit ill. And then what follows is the worst night of my life in the bathroom that I was sharing with Dan. To begin with, he and I both thought it was food poisoning. But then I started to get a really intense pain in my abdomen, so intense that I couldn't move, I couldn't sleep, it was horrible. And the bathroom episodes... Now, I should pause and say that I have an extreme aversion to any kind of bodily function talk, and so I'm just going to say bathroom episodes, and you're going to have to use your imaginations, because I'm not being any more specific than that. Other than to say, I've never had both happen at the same time. So these bathroom episodes continued for about 3 days. And on day three, Dan decides, let's go to hospital. The hospital in Vang Vieng was built by French nuns in the late 1900s and had not been cleaned since, I don't think. I had a scan, and the surgeon said to me, you've got appendicitis. You've got two options. You can either stay here and have the surgery, or you can go to Thailand, to an international hospital, and have the surgery there. But the journey might kill you. Go for the option that's not going to kill you. So I stay put. Surgeon goes away, comes back a couple of hours later, and he says, what are you still doing here? And I'm like, you said if I go, I'll die. No, he said. I said, if you go, you might die. If you stay, you'll die. And then he gestured broadly at the blood on the floor and the insects crawling up and down the walls. Now, at this point, I haven't slept in 3 days, I haven't eaten, I haven't had any water, I'm in so much pain I cannot think. I am in no state to make any kind of decision, life-threatening or otherwise. So this is when our hero, Dan, sort of Harry Potter, steps up to the plate. You're going to Thailand, an ambulance, I'm going to get the insurance company on the phone, you're not staying here. A little while later, a tin can on wheels rolls up and takes us the four-hour journey to the border. And it is the most pain I have ever felt in my life. We were going along unsealed, potholed-filled roads, and I really thought I was going to die. We have a stop-off at a border clinic. I have a couple more tests. Eventually, a Thai ambulance turns up, takes me to the Thai hospital. By this point, it's about 2 a.m. The surgeon comes to see me, says, yep, appendicitis, schedules the surgery for 6 a.m. At which point, I'm wheeled into an operating theatre where the nurses are sitting and listening to the 2001 pop classic Uncle Cracker's Follow Me, which I think we all know. Follow me and everything is... Come on, there we go! Which is what everyone wants to hear just before they have surgery. They give me an epidural, and as they're about to start cutting, I'm like, I'm not asleep! And they say to me, oh, you'd like to be asleep. Yes, yes, please. Very much so, I would like to be asleep. So they give me something to put me to sleep. But because it's not what's keeping me numb, I think they don't necessarily keep as close an eye on it as they should. And so I wake up a few times during the surgery. The first time I woke up, I complained that my face was itching. And so the very kind anaesthetist rubbed my face until I went back to sleep. The next time I woke up, they said to me, it's not your appendix, something else is the problem. Now, at this point, I am high as a freaking kite. So I'm like, take what you need to. Take it all. I don't care. Do it. I love your work. Also told them that we'd go for drinks afterwards. And they gave me. Anyway. What happened was, in the middle of my abdomen, they found a tumour about the size of a small melon. And the tumour had twisted itself around, cut off the blood supply to itself, and gone gangrenous inside me. They take the tumour out, they take the tubes, they take the ovary, they take the appendix, for good measure, I guess, and they send the tumour off to Bangkok for testing. It comes back non-cancerous. It is a benign tumour, a type of cyst called a mature teratoma. And these are tumours that have mature cells in them, so cells that look like other parts of your body. They can have full-blown organs in them. They're what, if you hear or if you read a trashy magazine that says, I ate my own twin in the womb, no, they didn't. They had a mature teratoma. And this is what I had. And mine had, my surgeon cheerfully informed me, bits of hair, bone, and cheesy material. Yeah. Enjoyed that image. The same surgeon also gave me the photos that the lab had taken and said, pop those in with your holiday snaps. And about 4 days later, 3 or 4 days later after the surgery, my mum arrived. My mum, who gets anxious going on a canal boat holiday, came halfway across the world to collect me and take me home. And never have I felt such relief. They say that travelling is meant to change you. Fairly sure they weren't talking about leaving organs behind in your country of choice.
So Becca's Storyteller's Night 10x9 Balham has details online. Thank you, Becca, for sharing. Some may say oversharing, but I like to be thinking that is definitely just good sharing.
I was listening to but not wanting to listen to. I wanted to listen to the human aspect, yep. But I didn't want to get a visual on the unit there.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Doing a talk, but it's quite medical, and I'm working out at the minute. I'm testing out on stage how medical to get. I know you're telling me now not to get too medical.
No, get really medical. It's funny.
You should get in on that stuff.
Yeah, interesting. Because I did a bit about castrating pigs, which I used to have to do.
Okay, that's the true thing.
Yeah, and I talked about cutting the balls there.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. You have experience with Canadians.
That's the farm, growing up on the farm. Nice.
So there you go. Medical overshare is okay. So good on Becca and good on all of us talking about medical stuff. Did I mention my navel-less gazing medical comedy show this weekend? Oh, I did. Sorry about that.
Rhythm gymnastics. Tell me about rhythm gymnastics. Rhythmic gymnastics. Well, of course. I'm on tour at the moment, actually. And so if people have been on to my tour show, they'll know my part in rhythmic gymnastics.
You have a part in that.
I was there at the very beginning, because there's always been people dancing with ribbons and balls.
Were you one of those, too?
But I just took it to a new level.
Right.
Mine was when I was being held prisoner by Joseph Stalin. Of course. At the Lubyanka prison. And Nikolai Yezhov was applying the dark arts to me. Really hard. And like really bad. Like, he's beating me awfully. He's only 5 foot, but strong. And and I just thought this is heading south. This right here is a bad situation. That's what I said to myself, because I didn't have any Russian at that time. And I thought, this is no good. This is a no good situation. It's like that time I was captured by ISIS. And I thought, well, that's the end of this. I said to him, look, you guys, quit it, I told him. Anyways, it was heading south, and I thought, how am I going to get out of this, the Lubyanka prison?
Yeah, I think you have similar thoughts as myself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, you've turned. That happens. That's why I keep a few friends. Everyone likes me for the first year or so.
A lot of stories, you can see the flow.
You'd think, how are you going to get out of that situation? Yeah. Well, in my cell was a little ribbon lying in the corner of the cell, and that's how rhythmic gymnastics was born.
Wow.
Yeah, Stalin loved it. Joseph Djugashvili. DJ Djugashvili. He was small too, 5'4". Pure evil, yellow eyes.
I feel like we've been all over, but mainly on a heist, which is lovely.
So I think we can sum it. I'll sum it up for you. Silk Road, good. Stalin, no good. No good at all. Rhythmic gymnastics, awesome. You know, silk. There's a tie in there. You have silk ribbons. Genghis Khan, great. And on tour. Till May.
I wish we had an hour, but we have Tony Law. Thank you.
Finally, we like to visit the Bay Window of Wisdom, our seventh corner of our seven-sided Heptagon Club. This week in the Bay Window of Wisdom, radio producer Chris Byland.
Do stuff and then apologise for it after.
Okay, good advice. I like that.
That's what I tend to do.
Right.
It seems to work. I don't have to apologise very often because it seems to work.
And there's little thinking time in radio, I imagine. You need to.
No.
You just need to do it.
No, sometimes you just need to do things as you see fit, as the moment calls it. If you think about it, then sometimes you over-engineer stuff.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Okay.
That's the best advice I could probably offer.
Act now.
Act now.
Apologise
later.
Very good.
Unless it's going to get you in a lot of trouble. Yes. Then maybe think a little bit.
Okay.
Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you to our seven fantastic guests. Seven more next time. That's how we roll, really. So more in a month. So that'll be probably late October 2017 for the next one. Thank you to Rob Halligan for this fine music. And thank you to you if you managed to come to my solo show in London, Liverpool and Nottingham, or the book launch in Guildford or London. You're most welcome. Just RSVP on the email.
Hey, has anybody said to you today?
Or buy a book if you managed to buy one. Have a look online.
Has made the world a better
Heart the Biography of Christmas. It's out there for the buying. More on that next time. Do donate if you wish. People have to the podcast, and I love them for it. Rate us on iTunes. We're on Facebook. You can like us there. Share us. We'll see you next time. More in a month. See you in October.